Chapter 65. It fell out on a day in this last autumn that I had to go down from London to a place of seaside resort on an hour's business, accompanied by my esteemed friend Bullfinch. Let the place of seaside resort be, for the nonce, called Namaliston. I had been loitering about Paris in very hot weather, pleasantly breakfasting in the open air in the garden of the Palace Royal or the Tuileries, pleasantly dining in the open air in the Elysian Fields, pleasantly taking my cigar and lemonade in the open air on the Italian Boulevard towards the small hours after midnight. Bullfinch, an excellent man of business, has summoned me back across the channel to transact this said hour's business at Namaliston, and thus it fell out that Bullfinch and I were in a railway carriage together on our way to Namaliston, each with his return ticket in his waistcoat pocket. Says Bullfinch, "I have a proposal to make. Let us dine at the Temeraire." Apostrophe, I asked Bullfinch, "Did he recommend the Temeraire?" Inasmuch as I had not been rated on the books of the Temeraire for many years. Bullfinch declined to accept the responsibility of recommending the Temeraire, but on the whole, was rather sanguine about it. He seemed to remember, apostrophe Bullfinch said, that he had dined well there. A plain dinner, but good. Certainly not like a Parisian dinner. Here Bullfinch obviously became the prey of want of confidence, but of its kind very fair. I appeal to Bullfinch's intimate knowledge of my wants and ways to decide whether I was usually ready to be pleased with any dinner, or for the matter of that with anything that was fair of its kind and really what it claimed to be. Bullfinch doing me the honor to respond in the affirmative, I agreed to ship myself as an able trencherman on board the Temeraire. "Now, our plan shall be this," apostrophe says Bullfinch, with his forefinger at his nose. "As soon as we get to Namaliston, we'll drive straight to the Temeraire and order a little dinner in an hour. And as we shall not have more than enough time in which to dispose of it comfortably, what do you say to giving the house the best opportunities of serving it hot and quickly by dining in the coffee room?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, what I had to say was, "Certainly." Bullfinch, who is by nature of a hopeful constitution, then began to babble of green geese. But I checked him in that Falstaffian vein, urging considerations of time and cookery. In due sequence of events we drove up to the Temeraire, and alighted. A youth in livery received us on the doorstep. "Looks well," apostrophe said Bullfinch confidentially. And then aloud, "Coffee room." Apostrophe, apostrophe, the youth in livery, now perceived to be Moldy, conducted us to the desired haven, and was enjoined by Bullfinch to send the waiter at once, as we wished to order a little dinner in an hour. Then Bullfinch and I waited for the waiter, until, the waiter continuing to wait in some unknown and invisible sphere of action, we rang for the waiter, which ring produced the waiter, who announced himself as not the waiter who ought to wait upon us, and who didn't wait a moment longer. So Bullfinch approached the coffee room door, and melodiously pitching his voice into a bar, where two young ladies were keeping the books of the Temeraire, apologetically explained that we wished to order a little dinner in an hour, and that we were debarred from the execution of our inoffensive purpose by consignment to solitude. Hereupon one of the young ladies ran a bell, which reproduced at the bar this time the waiter who was not the waiter who ought to wait upon us. That extraordinary man, whose life seemed consumed in waiting upon people to say that he wouldn't wait upon them, repeated his former protest with great indignation, and retired. Bullfinch, with a fallen countenance, was about to say to me, "This won't do," apostrophe, when the waiter who ought to wait upon us left off keeping us waiting at last. "Waiter," apostrophe said Bullfinch piteously, "we have been a long time waiting." Apostrophe, the waiter who ought to wait upon us laid the blame upon the waiter who ought not to wait upon us, and said it was all that waiter's fault. "We wish," apostrophe said Bullfinch, much depressed, "to order a little dinner in an hour. What can we have?" Apostrophe, what would you like to have, gentlemen? Apostrophe, apostrophe, Bullfinch, with extreme mournfulness of speech and action, and with a forlorn old fly-blown bill of fare in his hand which the waiter had given him, and which was a sort of general manuscript index to any cookery book you please, moved the previous question. We could have mock turtle soup, a sole, curry, and roast duck. Agreed. At this table by this window, punctually in an hour. I had been feigning to look out of this window, but I had been taking note of the crumbs on all the tables, the dirty tablecloths, the stuffy, soupy, airless atmosphere, the stale leavings everywhere about, the deep gloom of the waiter who ought to wait upon us, and the stomachache with which a lonely traveler at a distant table in a corner was too evidently afflicted. I now pointed out to Bullfinch the alarming circumstance that this traveler had dined. We hurriedly debated whether, without infringement of good breeding, we could ask him to disclose if he had partaken of mock turtle, sole, curry, or roast duck. We decided that the thing could not be politely done, and we had set our own stomachs on a cast, and they must stand the hazard of the die. I hold phrenology, within certain limits, to be true. I am much of the same mind as to the subtler expressions of the hand. I hold physiognomy to be infallible, though all these sciences demand rare qualities in the student. But I also hold that there is no more certain index to personal character than the condition of a set of casters is to the character of any hotel. Knowing, and having often tested this theory of mine, Bullfinch resigned himself to the worst, when, laying aside any remaining veil of disguise, I held up before him in succession the cloudy oil and furry vinegar, the clogged cayenne, the dirty salt, the obscene dregs of soy, and the anchovy sauce in a flannel waistcoat of decomposition. We went out to transact our business. So inspiriting was the relief of passing into the clean and windy streets of Namaliston from the heavy and vapid closeness of the coffee room of the Temeraire, that hope began to revive within us. We began to consider that perhaps the lonely traveler had taken physic, or done something injudicious, to bring his complaint on. Bullfinch remarked that he thought the waiter who ought to wait upon us had brightened a little when suggesting curry. And although I knew him to have been at that moment the express image of despair, I allowed myself to become elevated in spirits. As we walked by the softly lapping sea, all the notabilities of Namaliston, who are forever going up and down with the changelessness of the tides, passed to and fro in procession. Pretty girls on horseback, and with detested riding masters, pretty girls on foot, mature ladies in hats, spectacled, strong-minded, and glaring at the opposite or weaker sex. The stock exchange was strongly represented. Jerusalem was strongly represented. The bores of the prosier London clubs were strongly represented. Fortune hunters of all denominations were there, from hirsute insolvency, in a curricle, to closely buttoned swindlery in doubtful boots, on the sharp lookout for any likely young gentleman disposed to play a game at billiards round the corner. Masters of languages, their lessons finished for the day, were going to their homes out of sight of the sea. Mistresses of accomplishments, carrying small portfolios, likewise tripped homeward. Pairs of scholastic pupils, two and two, went languidly along the beach, surveying the face of the waters, as if waiting for some ark to come and take them off. Spectres of the George the Fourth days flitted unsteadily among the crowd, bearing the outward semblance of ancient dandies, of every one of whom it might be said, not that he had one leg in the grave, or both legs, but that he was steeped in grave to the summit of his high shirt collar, and had nothing real about him but his bones. Alone stationary in the midst of all the movements, the Namaliston boatman leaned against the railings and yawned, and looked out to sea, or looked at the moored fishing boats and at nothing. Such is the unchanging manner of life with this nursery of our hardy seamen, and very dry nurses they are, and always wanting something to drink. The only two nautical personages detached from the railing were the two fortunate possessors of the celebrated monstrous unknown barking fish, just caught frequently just caught off Namelistan, who carry them about in a hamper, and pressed the scientific to look in at the lid. The sands of the hour had all run out when we got back to the Temeraire. Says Bullfinch then, to the youth in livery, with boldness, lavatory. ... When we arrived at the family vault with a skylight, which the youth in livery presented as the institution sought, we had already whisked off our cravats and coats, but finding ourselves in the presence of an evil smell, and no linen, but two crumpled towels newly damp from the countenances of two somebody else's, we put on our cravats and coats again, and fled unwashed to the coffee room. There the waiter who ought to wait upon us had set forth our knives and forks and glasses, on the cloth whose dirty acquaintance we had already had the pleasure of making, and which we were pleased to recognize by the familiar expression of its stains. And now there occurred the truly surprising phenomenon, that the waiter who ought not to wait upon us swooped down upon us, clutched our loaf of bread, and vanished with the same. Bullfinch, with distracted eyes, was following this unaccountable figure out at the portal, ... like the ghost in Hamlet, when the waiter who ought to wait upon us jostled against it, carrying a tureen. Waiter. ... said a severe diner, lately finished, perusing his bill fiercely through his eyeglass. The waiter put down our tureen on a remote side table, and went to see what was amiss in this new direction. This is not right, you know, waiter. Look here. Here's yesterday's sherry, 1 and 8 pence, and here we are again, 2 shillings. And what does 6 pence mean? ... So far from knowing what 6 pence meant, the waiter protested that he didn't know what anything meant. He wiped the perspiration from his clammy brow, and said it was impossible to do it, not particularizing what, and the kitchen was so far off. Take the bill to the bar, and get it altered, ... said Mr. Indignation Cocker, so to call him. The waiter took it, looked intensely at it, didn't seem to like the idea of taking it to the bar, and submitted, as a new light upon the case, that perhaps 6 pence meant 6 pence. I tell you again, ... said Mr. Indignation Cocker, here's yesterday's sherry, can't you see it, 1 and 8 pence, and here we are again, 2 shillings. What do you make of 1 and 8 pence and 2 shillings? ... Totally unable to make anything of 1 and 8 pence and 2 shillings, the waiter went out to try, if anybody else could, merely casting a helpless backward glance at Bullfinch, in acknowledgement of his pathetic entreaties for our soup tureen. After a pause, during which Mr. Indignation Cocker read a newspaper and coughed defiant coughs, Bullfinch arose to get the tureen, when the waiter reappeared and brought it, dropping Mr. Indignation Cocker's altered bill on Mr. Indignation Cocker's table as he came along. It's quite impossible to do it, gentlemen, ... murmured the waiter. And the kitchen is so far off. ... Well, you don't keep the house. It's not your fault, we suppose. Bring some sherry. ... Waiter. ... From Mr. Indignation Cocker, with a new and burning sense of injury upon him. The waiter, arrested on his way to our sherry, stopped short, and came back to see what was wrong now. Will you look here? This is worse than before. Do you understand? Here's yesterday's sherry, 1 and 8 pence, and here we are again, 2 shillings. And what the devil does 9 pence mean? ... This new portent utterly confounded the waiter. He wrung his napkin, and mutely appealed to the ceiling. Waiter, fetch that sherry, ... says Bullfinch, in open wrath and revolt. I want to know, ... persisted Mr. Indignation Cocker, the meaning of 9 pence. I want to know the meaning of sherry 1 and 8 pence yesterday, and of here we are again 2 shillings. Send somebody. ... The distracted waiter got out of the room on pretext of sending somebody, and by that means got our wine. But the instant he appeared with our decanter, Mr. Indignation Cocker descended on him again. Waiter. ... You will now have the goodness, To attend to our dinner, waiter, apostrophe said Bullfinch, sternly. I am very sorry, but it's quite impossible to do it, gentlemen, apostrophe pleaded the waiter, and the kitchen apostrophe, waiter. Apostrophe apostrophe said Mr. Indignation Cocker. Apostrophe is, apostrophe resumed the waiter, so far off, that apostrophe, waiter. Apostrophe apostrophe persisted Mr. Indignation Cocker, send somebody. Apostrophe, we were not without our fears, that the waiter rushed out to hang himself, and we were much relieved by his fetching somebody, in graceful, flowing skirts and with a waist, who very soon settled Mr. Indignation Cocker's business. Oh! Apostrophe apostrophe said Mr. Cocker, with his fire surprisingly quenched by this apparition. I wish to ask about this bill of mine, because it appears to me that there's a little mistake here. Let me show you. Here's yesterday's sherry 1 and 8 pence, and here we are again 2 shillings. And how do you explain 9 pence? Apostrophe, however it was explained, in tones too soft to be overheard. Mr. Cocker was heard to say nothing more than IHH. Indeed. Thank you. Yes, apostrophe and shortly afterwards went out, a milder man. The lonely traveler with the stomachache had all his time suffered severely, drawing up a leg now and then, and sipping hot brandy and water with grated ginger in it. When we tasted our very mock turtle soup, and were instantly seized with symptoms of some disorder simulating apoplexy, and occasioned by the surcharge of nose and brain with lukewarm dishwater holding in solution sour flour, poisonous condiments, and, say, 75% of miscellaneous kitchen stuff rolled in 2 balls, we were inclined to trace his disorder to that source. On the other hand, there was a silent anguish upon him too strongly resembling the results established within ourselves by the sherry, to be discarded from alarmed consideration. Again, we observed him, with terror, to be Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.